This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Kids are naturally curious, but when it comes to school, it seems like their minds are turned off. Why is it that they can remember the smallest details from their favorite television program, yet miss the most obvious questions on their history test? This is the conundrum that Dan Willingham of the University of Virginia attempts to answer in his new book, Why Don't Students Like School? A cognitive scientist answers questions about how the mind works and what it means for the classroom. It's an honor to welcome live in studio Professor Willingham from the University of Virginia. How are you, Dan?
Well, thanks. Thanks so much for having me, Clark.
Absolutely. Been looking forward to it. It's a great book. We're going to give away a copy at the end of the interview, and folks should know that there's lots of pictures.
Absolutely. Yeah, make sure of that. Very few graphs, lots of pictures.
Yes, lots of pictures and diagrams, yeah. And it very, very clearly lays out where you're coming from. Before we delve into the topic of what's going on with kids and schools today, give us Dan Willingham 101, where you're from and how you ended up teaching psychology.
Sure. Yeah. So I got my degree, my PhD in psychology in 1990. So I'm a cognitive psychologist. So when I say I'm a psychologist, people often say, oh, well, let me tell you about my mother or something. I'm not that type of psychologist. Even though I am a psychologist, I study how people think. And for the first 10 years or so of my career, I was a basic researcher and studied brain mechanisms of memory, what happens in the brain when you're learning new things. And in about the year 2000, I got involved really by accident in education, K-12 education. I started getting invited to talk to teachers about cognitive psychology and what it might mean for education. My first response was always, I don't know anything about education. I'm a psychologist. The response was always, that's good. That's what we want. We want someone who doesn't know anything about just give us what psychologists think. And I got more and more interested. And so a couple of years ago, I actually shut down my lab doing basic research. And since that time, I've been writing for and speaking to teachers exclusively and just talking about what basic scientists know about the mind and brain and how that might inform what's happening in the classroom.
Fantastic. So I would imagine that what you get a lot from teachers today is a lot of frustration.
Oh, yes.
You know, these people who are on the front lines with our kids trying to make their lives better, and they see these, most times, bright kids who for some reason can't do well in school. They're not engaged. They're not motivated. They don't like it. And yet the minute they walk out and pick up a video game or start watching a TV program they like, their brains do amazing things with memory and recall and deduction.
Absolutely.
And finding patterns and, you know, stuff that they should be doing in school.
That's exactly right. And that's just one source of teachers' frustration. Teachers have a lot on their plate. But the problem you bring up, this is exactly what the title of the book, right? Why is it students don't like school more? If you ask 100 high school seniors, do you like to learn new things? Almost all of them are going to say, yeah, I'm a curious person. I like to learn new things. But if you ask those same 100 kids, do you enjoy school? You will not find almost all of them saying that they like school. So why is that? That was the problem I was interested in. And the solution that I propose in the book is that, oddly enough, the mind is not really designed for thinking. The mind is actually designed to save us from having to think. We are biased not to think. So let me explain a little bit what I mean by that, because that sounds weird, right? We normally think that humans are this. We're sort of the pinnacle of evolution or creation or whichever you want to say in terms of thought, that we're really, really good at thinking. And compared to most animals, we are really good at many types of thought. There are certain types of thought other animals are better than us, but most types of thought we're very good at it. But compared to other things that our mind does, thinking is not what it does best. So thinking is, when you stop and consider, thinking is very slow, it's very effortful, and it's really uncertain. When you're presented with a problem, and by a problem, I don't just mean something in school, I mean, it could be anything. You're planning a garden in your backyard, or you're sizing up an investment opportunity. That takes a lot of effort on your part and a lot of time on your part, and you may not even come up with an answer. And if you come up with an answer, it may not be a good answer. Now, compared to other things that our mind does, there are other mental processes that we're really good at. Like, the best one is vision. Vision, you very rarely see something mistakenly. You, when vision gives you very good answers, it's incredibly rapid too. You walk into a room and you immediately know what all the objects are, where they are, and so forth.
And you don't really have to think about it.
And you don't have to think about it. It's effortless, right? Now compare that, our abilities, to those of a computer, right? Computers crush us in most types of thought that we think of as important. Mathematics. You can buy a calculator for $5. It's much better at mathematics, faster and more reliable than anybody on the planet, right? But there is not the best computer in the world can't drive a truck. And the reason is the best computer in the world can't see in a rapidly changing environment well enough to be able to update what ought to happen in the truck, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what do we, when I say that we're not very good at thinking, how do we sort of get through our day? How do you, I mean, what, how did I get here to the studio, right? Well, the answer is we very often will rely on memory. Memory is not as good as our ability to see, but memory is very fast, it's really effortless, and it's fairly reliable. We all think we have a terrible memory system. Actually, your memory is pretty good. So when you're confronted with a problem, you're biased to, at first, the first thing you're going to try is, have I solved a problem like this before? And if I have, if it kind of worked out, I'm just going to do the same thing again. So that's the bias that, you know, when you're going to make spaghetti sauce at home, you know, you could turn this into an exciting, bracing challenge of cognitive complexity. Say, I'm going to get out all my cookbooks and I'm going to compare them. I'm going to have all the recipes for spaghetti sauce and I'm going to, you know, base my evaluation on visual appeal and flavor. And but you don't do that. You just make spaghetti sauce the way you always do, right? Because
yeah.
It's just too effortful to do anything else.
And that memory is existing neural pathways that we've already built in the brain. To borrow a metaphor for roads, those are built roads in the brain. And to learn something new, you got to build new roads, right?
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's effortful. Now you contrast that. So that's one idea that we're sort of biased not to think. But if you consider for a moment, you realize, well, that can't be the whole story. Because in fact, people do like to think, right? People have hobbies that are challenging.
They involve spaghetti sauce.
Right. They say, I want to make a new spaghetti sauce. Or they do crossword puzzles. Or they watch, you know, challenging documentaries and so on. So when is it that we like to think? And the answer seems to be that it's not so much that we like to think, but we like thought that is successful. It brings pleasure. It brings a sort of snap of satisfaction when you do some mental work and you see that it actually works out, right? So the times that people are intrigued and want to work further on a problem is when they size it up and they say, you know, if I put a little effort into this, I'm going to get that mental satisfaction. I'm going to get that good feeling. So the problems you avoid are problems where you look at it and you can tell very quickly, this is too hard. I may work on this really, really hard, but I'm not going to get that good feeling. Or when the problem's too easy. So if I hand you a crossword puzzle that's designed for a first grader, you know, I'll succeed, but it doesn't even feel like solving a problem.
I had to think, but it was no fun.
Yeah, right. Well, I didn't even have to think, right? I was just drawing on memory. I was
right.
Just sort of filling in the squares. It wasn't interesting at all. It wasn't challenging enough. So there's this sort of sweet spot of difficulty where it's difficult enough, where it takes a little bit of effort, but it's not so difficult that I can't get it. And that's when you get people really interested and intrigued and willing to put some mental effort into it. So going back to where you started from, what is it about school where we've got these kids who are really smart and they go home and they're, you know, programming a new video game or they're doing, you know, some incredible cognitive feat, whereas at school they don't seem engaged. It's very, very difficult when you have a classroom of 25 kids at different levels of preparation for a teacher to find the sweet spot of difficulty for all 25 simultaneously.
Yeah, you got to find a sweet spot for all of them as a group instead of one-on-one.
Exactly, exactly. And that's terrifically challenging for teachers. So I think that's the core of the problem.
We're talking with Professor Dan Willingham of the University of Virginia. His new book is Why Don't Students Like School? He explores how the mind works and what it means for the classroom. Well, let's explore some of the solutions or what's working. When you stand back and you look at, let's talk public education system today, which, you know, so many people, whether on the inside or on the outside, say it's broken. It just doesn't work like it's meant to work.
Yes.
And it doesn't work as well for our kids and for the teachers as it should be.
Yes.
And so we need to rebuild this thing from the ground up.
Right.
What do we do?
This is a terrible terrible problem, right? And there, so what I'm going to start off doing is describing why the problem is so tough, and then maybe I'll have one or two things to say about things that ways that things could be done better. One of the reasons that it's that we have very little idea of what's working and not working is our data are absolutely terrible on what's actually happening in classrooms. You would think that educational researchers would be, you know, fascinated to know what's happening in the nation's classrooms. We have only the dimmest idea of what's happening in classrooms. So in terms of what's working and what's not working, we have a sort of an okay idea of what kids know. We don't even know that much about what kids know, but that's one thing No Child Left Behind, a positive outcome of No Child Left Behind, is that testing became much more systematic. Now, the tests in many states are not very good at all, but at least we're starting to think about the fact that, well, it'd be good to know what kids know when they get out of school. But in terms of, so we can say, well, this state's things seem to be going well, this state things don't seem to be going well, this district and so forth. But what's actually happening in that state or in that district, we have only the dimmest idea.
The SOLs can't necessarily tell you what's actually going on in the classroom because in so many ways, we're not looking apples to apples in so many of these places, right?
That's exactly right.
If assuming we have the apple to look at.
That's right. And so, taking the SOLs, I mean, you can look at and discover that a particular district or even a particular school is doing really well, but that doesn't mean that and another one is not, but the kids may have started off coming from very different places, right? So just entering into the kindergarten classroom, one set of kids may have been in homes where there were lots of books in the homes. The parents talked to the kids about ideas in the homes. The vocabulary was very rich. And other kids coming from really disadvantaged homes where there aren't any books. The parents are, harried and they're working two jobs and so on. They don't have time to talk to their kids. And so it's totally not apples to apples making those comparisons.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, go ahead with your exploring this idea of how it's broken and what we might do.
Yeah. So one thing that a lot of people have been interested in the last couple of years is looking internationally at other nations that seem to be doing a better job than we do, and especially in math and science. Everybody is very, very concerned about math and science right now. One of the big secrets seems to be having a solid curriculum that begins at point A and ends at point Z, and recognizing that especially for something like mathematics, the knowledge is really hierarchical. You really can't tackle a topic until you have mastered the topics that lead up to it. And so you really do need a set curriculum. It doesn't really jive very well with the American way of thinking about education, which is very decentralized. And people get very nervous when you talk about a national curriculum. And I'm, in fact, not in favor of a national curriculum. But you have to distinguish between having a general outline of what topics are going to be covered in what year versus doing something like they do in some Asian countries like Singapore, where it's not just a curriculum, it's actually lesson plans. So the Minister of Education knows it's Tuesday at 2:30. All the third graders are doing thus and so right now, right?
Wow.
That's not what you want, right?
Or yeah.
It just would not fit with them.
Americans wouldn't buy that.
Americans would not go for that at all, and I don't blame them.
But that said, yeah. Is that successful?
It's very successful. I mean, this is, Singapore was not, I didn't pick that accidentally. I mean, that's the country that right now everyone is looking to in math and science.
And that's because they say you're going to learn this at this time and everyone's going to do it.
There's probably lots of reasons, right? That's why, this is another reason why when you talk about how can we make the system better, there's so many variables operating simultaneously. It's very, very difficult to disentangle which are the really important ones. Singapore, they have terrific textbooks. They have a highly trained sort of elite set of teachers. So, how can we encourage more people in this country to go into teaching? Well, that brings up a whole other set of issues. Are teachers compensated adequately in this country and so forth?
No. Let's call a spade a spade.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, they're just not at all levels. College level and preschool.
Well, this is one of our problems with our highly decentralized system. In some districts, teachers are very well paid. And in other districts, it's an absolute scandal what teachers are paid.
Yeah. Dan Willingham is the author of the new book, Why Don't Students Like School? And we will be giving away a copy here in just a few minutes, so stay tuned. Before we let you go, let me ask you about this. There's been a lot of talk about, and parents ask this question, learning, teaching styles, like different ways to learn, and that seems to be a big buzzword. Yes. Like, well, your child needs to be taught this way. And,
right. You're a visual learner, or you're an auditory learner.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll see school systems and school boards buy into that.
Absolutely.
That vocabulary and think, well, maybe we need to teach differently and we'll do better and have a different style of teaching. Is there much, does that hold water, this whole idea?
It doesn't. It doesn't. And this is something that surprises people. And I've actually polled my classes at the University of Virginia and asked, you know, I've got a big class of 350 kids, how many of you have heard about visual versus auditory versus kinesthetic learning? And all of them not only heard about it, but they, about 90% believe that it's true. And it turns out there's no research basis for this at all. There's been tons and tons of studies done on this. We all have sort of the intuition that different people sort of have different preferences about how to think. Some people are big picture people and some people are interested in details. And people think of themselves, I really need to see it. I'm a visual learner. Whereas other people say, I like to hear it, or I like to manipulate things. I'm a kinesthetic learner. So you have to be careful about what the specific prediction is of this theory. The theory is that if, for example, if you were a visual learner and I were an auditory learner.
I am. I'm totally right brain. Okay. Very right brain.
Okay. Right brain versus left brain. There's another one. That's another one.
I loved geometry. I hated algebra.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there's a big difference between ability and style, right? Abilities, absolutely nobody disagrees with that you can be a math person or you can be good with words or something like that. But that's very different than style. So the idea behind a style is it's not that with an ability, more is always better, right? You'd always be more mathematically inclined. But the idea of a style is it's not that being visual or auditory is any better or worse. It's just this is your preferred way of learning, right? So abilities, everybody agrees. Naturally, people have their own abilities, and that's not controversial. The question is whether I can take the same ideas, the same material, and present it to you in one way or another way, and you'll catch on one way, and the other way, it'll be much harder for you to get.
Yeah.
And the strong prediction, the really key prediction is that's going to be true across a number of different tasks and across days. It's going to be a consistent aspect of your personality or of your cognitive makeup. And that idea has been tested repeatedly over about the last 50 years, and in lots of different ways, right brain, left brain, you know, holistic thinker versus linear thinker, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, none of them hold up.
Really?
Yeah.
So we need to get that word out to the school boards.
I'm trying. Yeah.
Because they'll throw so much money behind the new teaching fad.
Someone told me, and I don't know if this is true, someone told me there's actually a school district where every student has to wear a color-coded button that describes whether they're a visual and auditory or kinesthetic learner.
Damn.
Yeah, and it's not only money. I mean, I think it's teachers' time, and it's a big problem.
Yeah.
It's a big problem. Chasing after something that's just not going to work.
Dan Willingham is the author of the new book, Why Don't Students Like School? A cognitive scientist answers questions about how the mind works and what it means for the classroom. It's must reading for school teachers and parents. Fascinating new book. Dan, please join us again. This was great.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.